The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We're off and running on another week of broadcasting during this holiday week, I guess, at least for the United States. You've got the 4th of July festivities on Wednesday, and hopefully we'll have a live program for you on that day, as well as the others around this U.S. holiday. Speaking of holiday excursions, I guess it wasn't a holiday yesterday. Well, yeah, it was Canada Day. Some of our Canadian students reminded us of that. But we headed down to Chartwell, about a 2.5-hour drive from Edstone. I think all total we had 30 of us. Chartwell, of course, is the residence of the Churchill family, or at least it was from something like the early 1920s. All the way through to just before Winston Churchill's death in 1965. I think he moved out in 1964 because he spent a fair bit of his last days in hospital, and I think at the apartment he had in London. In any event, it was a really inspiring day to see this residence. My son and I took our Manchester books down there just to read a few pages. I think he read quite a few more than me because I got about 5 pages in and then decided I needed to take a little bit of a nap. So my wife chided me for that a little bit later. But I said that it was about, I think, 2 p.m. in the afternoon. We were waiting to get into the house for our scheduled appointment. And the thought occurred to me that at 2 in the afternoon, back when Churchill lived in this residence, he would have been sound asleep. So I got in my Churchill reading. I got in my Churchill nap. I got in quite a few Churchillian things during our field trip yesterday. A really inspiring day. A day that also, I think, made me appreciate Edstone. Churchill said, I bought Chartwell for the view. And it is. It's a stunning view. The lakes, the ponds, the rolling hills. There's quite a few more rolling hills than there are around Edstone. But really, I think Edstone was something that captured, I forget how many of us viewed the property, 4 or 5 of us back in 2014. But really, this property here is the kind of property that just takes your breath away. Even before you go in and look at the structure itself. And in some ways, Edstone is more beautiful and breathtaking than even Chartwell. I mean, for Churchill to find the Chartwell estate and to have it so close to London, which he obviously needed it to be, I mean, it's a stunning setting. Although his wife never did like it, but that's another story. In any event, he saw the potential in this property. And he worked hard on the property, and of course he worked in the house, so we saw his study and the library and where he produced so much work. And again, having read about some of this in the last few months, it was great to finally see it. This is from Manchester's book, by the way. He lays 90 bricks an hour, which is a very high output, and Churchill himself was quoted as saying, 200 bricks and 2,000 words in a day. That was the goal that he set for himself, to get in a combination of labor outside, physical labor outside, and of course, some work inside, laying those bricks, so to speak, on pieces of paper, using that pen, mobilizing the English language, as Edward R. Murrow said about Mr. Churchill. He loved Chartwell. He said a day away from Chartwell is a day wasted. He wouldn't leave, or he didn't want to leave. It was just so uplifting. Last week I gave that show, if you remember, on positive mental health. And Churchill, or rather Chartwell for Churchill, was just such a wonderful uplift for him. And while we were on the property yesterday, by the way, we visited his studio as well, which is not far from the house itself. his art studio where he painted all of these wonderful paintings. And he took it up, as I explained a year or two ago on another program. He took up painting at the age of 41. And, of course, later in life, he said if it wasn't for painting, he couldn't live. I brought this out last week. He couldn't bear the strain of things if he couldn't get away and paint. And then when you look at the things that he painted, all of these beauties in God's creation, beautiful paintings. We were listening to the man inside the studio just to giving us some of the background to the studio and some of the paintings on the wall. He had one on there, and the fellow suggested that that might have been the very first one that he painted back in 1916 or 17. When he was in his early 40s. And even there, I mean, you could see that Churchill had some ability, but you could also see that when you compare that first one to some of the other ones in the studio, that he really did improve over the years. And in fact, he'd invite these famous artists, these famous painters, to come and spend time with him at Chartwell. If you know anything about the way Churchill ran the estate, I mean, he had people coming in and out of Chartwell all the time. Politicians, commentators, painters, just about anyone of prominence. So, as was explained to us by the guide yesterday, he'd bring in these famous painters, and he'd want to learn from them, learn from the best. Well, there were two paintings of the same scene in the studio there at Chartwell. We saw these yesterday, and the guide asked us. One of them was by the professional painter, and the other was by Winston Churchill. And so the guide asked us, which one do you think Churchill painted? And a few of us, you know, had different opinions that we sort of barked out. But I suggested that the brighter one was Churchill's, because he was known to use bright pastels. Bold, bright colors. And the guide said, well, that's exactly right. And if you look at this particular painting, it was a landscape of the area around Chartwell. But if you just compare it to the one who was the so-called professional, I mean, it not only looked more realistic, but it was just a brighter, more uplifting scene as well. And it says a lot about Churchill, as I said last week. And last week, that show, it was last Wednesday, I believe it was, just how important it is to have a positive mental outlook, or how much a positive mental outlook impacts even your physical health. I mean, that was something, as I say, Churchill really fell back on. Routinely, it kept him positive when there were a lot of reasons to be negative and discouraged. This quote from, well, it comes out from his, I forget the essay that he did on painting. It's one of his most famous essays, Churchill's, but it's discussed in Boris Johnson's book on Churchill. He's talking about his first experience here with painting. I read this a couple years ago, but he says here, so very gingerly, I mixed a little blue paint in the palette with a very small brush, and then with infinite precaution, made a mark about as big as a bean upon the affronted snow-white shield. It was a challenge, a deliberate challenge, but so subdued, so halting, indeed so cataleptic, that it deserved no response. From this chariot, there stepped, talking about someone that had approached the house, there stepped swiftly and lightly none other than the gifted wife of Sir John Lavery. Painting! But what are you hesitating about? She said. Let me have the brush, the big one. It says here, splash into the turpentine, wallop into the blue and white, frantic flourish on the palette, clean no longer, and then several large, fierce strokes and slashes of blue on the absolutely cowering canvas. Anyone could see that it could not hit back. No evil fate avenged the jaunty violence. The canvas grinned in helplessness before me. The spell was broken. The sickly inhibitions rolled away. I seized the largest brush and fell upon my victim with berserk fury. I had never felt any awe of a canvas since. He went after the canvas with large, bold, bright strokes. And in many ways, I mean, this is why painting, I think, or at least painting the way that Churchill did, suited him so well because it really typified the kind of life he led. He carried himself through life with these large, bold strokes. Manchester makes the point in his book that there were those who said of Churchill that he has, you know, something like 50 or 100 ideas every day, good new ideas every day, and only 3 or 4 of them are really good. But that's just the way that this man operated. He didn't hit the jackpot every single time, but he, when he did, because of these large, bold strokes, it's pretty amazing what this man was able to accomplish because of the bold action that he took, action that a few others were willing to take. We're going to talk later on that. Coming up in the next segment, we'll spend some time on this history, not so much the painting, but just this man of action that Winston Churchill was. It's pretty impressive, particularly when you look at the courage that he had during the wilderness years. And then when he finally did step into that position of leadership, late 1939 as First Lord of the Admiralty, and then finally as Prime Minister in May of 1940, he immediately took action. And in so doing, he saved Britain and the West. He did. As I say, we'll come more to that in just a bit. Let me just run through a few, or at least a couple of news items from over the weekend. Yesterday, as you may have seen, Mexico selected its version of Bernie Sanders, basically. Andre Manuel López Obrador, I guess, is how you pronounce his last name. He got 54% of the vote. According to the Times of London here, it was the biggest landslide victory in 30 years. He's 64 years of age. He used to be the mayor of Mexico City. And he promised the Mexican people a complete change in government, and change is coming. And as we touched on, I think, last week or the week before, I mean, this has been some kind of violent electoral season in Mexico. 132 politicians and political supporters have been killed, murdered, over the last 9 months of campaigning. That's astonishing. 132 people, many of them well-known politicians. 22 of Mexico's 31 states have had at least one political assassination since last September. That's what's been going on in Mexico, just south of America's border, since last September. At least 48 of those killed were candidates for the election, while others were, as I say, supporters or members of certain political parties or whatever. So the drug cartels or whatever the influences were, it's been a violent political campaign these past 9 months or so. From the New Yorker, this is from last week, it says about this new Mexican leader, Obrador promised a sober, austere government, a government without privilege. López Obrador frequently uses privilege as a term of disparagement, along with elite and especially power mafia, as he describes his enemies in the political and business communities. We're going to lower the salaries of those who are on top to increase the salaries of those on the bottom. He's a good socialist. We're going to spread the wealth. And he went on to say, I mean, everything I'm saying, it's going to be done. Which is probably the surest sign that it won't be. But that's another story. What's interesting here, though, is that many are saying it's because of Donald Trump and his trade policies and such, and clamping down on border security, that's the reason Mexico has kind of swung to the other extreme from someone that was, you know, more conservative, more pro-American, to someone who's now, like I say, another Bernie Sanders, who's making all these promises. Everyone's going to have wealth and prosperity. Everyone's going to have money. But the other thing about this particular president is that he's all but encouraging Mexicans to leave and to go to the United States. Victor Davis Hanson, addressed this in his column from a week or two ago, again, writing on the assumption that this López Obrador would win. He said, in a few days, Mexico could elect one of its more anti-American figures in recent memory. It says about Obrador that he's often advanced the idea that a strangely aggrieved Mexico has the right to monitor the status of its citizens living illegally in the United States. Lately, he trumped that notion of entitlement by assuring fellow Mexicans that they have a human right to enter the United States as they please. So just look at what's happening on both sides of America's southern border. As Donald Trump is trying to secure the border, wants to build a wall. Of course, he's facing all kinds of resistance within the United States. And then on the other side, now they've got a president who just wants as many of the, particularly the poorer ones, to go to the United States, where they can get some money and then send it back to Mexico. It says here, Obrador went on to urge his fellow Mexicans to leave their towns and to find a life in the United States. I mean, that's a human right. Who's to stop them? I can't stop them. Donald Trump can't stop them. They should be able to do it. And of course, he knows. I think it's been estimated that Mexico brings back something like $30 billion each year in these remittances, as they're called. Mexicans that go into America, they make more money, and then they send some of it back home. It says that huge cash influx is the concrete reality behind Obrador's otherwise unhinged rhetoric about exercising veto power over U.S. immigration law. So there's lots of things that this could impact. The illegal immigration, as I say, just the resistance against America's new president, Donald Trump. Also, of course, the prophesied trade war that's coming, that's really in the early stages already. Isaiah 23, the Mart of Nations. There was an article last year about this time, well, I guess a little over a year, April 2017, about Latin America being the front line of trade war. That was by Richard Palmer. And it's interesting, again, like with any Trumpet magazine, you go back, as I read last week, I mean, you read about these current events, and then you go back and see what we were saying a year, two, three, four, 20 years ago sometimes. It's pretty amazing. In that article from last April, Richard refers to that prophecy in Deuteronomy 28 and verse 52 about being besieged in all of our gates and how that for that to happen. I mean, you have to have nations in Central and South America turning against the United States. And so we're going to see the U.S. eventually frozen out when it comes to trade. And of course, the United States and Britain are already losing all of the sea gates. This is what the Trumpet said last year. Yet it would not take a new president for Mexico to form closer trade relations. This is Richard basically saying, you know, this could lead to a new president in Mexico that's more anti-American. Well, that's now happened. But he says here, yet it would not take a new president for Mexico to form closer trade relations with foreign powers. The nation is alarmed by Mr. Trump's anti-trade rhetoric, promises of tariffs, and his opposition to U.S. companies moving south of the border, and thus is already trying to reduce its dependence on the U.S. To do this, it's reaching out to South American trade bloc, Mercosur, as well as to Europe and China. That's the long term. In the short run, again, there's probably going to be some short-term benefit to the Trump administration's trade policies, because the U.S., and particularly with the economy being where it is right now, I mean, the U.S. is in a pretty strong position in the global economy. But it's not going to take much for things to change, and it won't take that long either. I mean, look at what's happening in Germany. I pointed this out last week. You know how Angela Merkel's gone from being the savior of the West, basically, of the post World War II order, following the election of Donald Trump. That's the way that the media, many in the media, took it. And now look at where she is today. in this fight with Horst Seehofer. They met over the weekend. And you, as we covered last week, I mean, there's been the back and forth. Seehofer's party saying, that's it. You know, the Christian Social Union, CSU, we've had enough of this, all of this immigration. We're going to start clamping down on our borders in Bavaria. And, of course, Angela Merkel won't have it. She wants to let everyone in. Seehofer wants to tighten border security. Well, what are we to make of the meeting they had over the weekend? Seehofer came out of that saying he was threatening to resign. And his party doesn't want him to do this. And, well, Merkel doesn't want him to do it either because this is their coalition. If Seehofer were to resign, then that's going to leave Merkel's party, the CDU, without a majority. And then she'd have to either reach out to another group or just have a minority government. This is the worst crisis she's faced in her time as chancellor. And as we said last year, even as she was trying to set up a new government, just given the way that it all started, that the stage was being set for a strong man to show up. The New York Times said this yesterday, whatever the outcome, the last 2 weeks have left the chancellor badly damaged and many Germans wondering how much longer she's going to last. They've exposed the spectacular weakening of a leader who not long ago was seen as a key defender of liberal values. That's the New York Times pointing out what we did last week. This is a spectacular weakening of a leader who, just not that long ago, was seen as the defender of liberal values. The New York Times says observers say Ms. Merkel is a political dead woman walking. How about that? For just how fast things can change. It's all prophesied. I mean, we've been saying since the very earliest days of the trumpet, going back to the early 1990s, to watch for a strong German leader. You watch out when Germany calls for a new Führer. Your Bible says, go ahead and scoff, but look at these other things that we've been telling you to prepare for. They're happening. The crisis, as we said back in 1991, it's probably going to be triggered by some kind of economic collapse. But here more recently, if you go back to a 2009 Key of David program, my father talked about this strong man. He's prophesied in Daniel 8 to come in, not by a vote. He's not going to be popularly elected into office. He comes in with flatteries. And my father said on a Key of David program in 2009 that this leader, this Daniel 8 strong man, could perhaps take advantage of a weak coalition. That's a direct quote. And now we see Germany with a very weak coalition. A weak coalition, to say the least. She has been badly damaged from these last 2 weeks. And really, the whole coalition has been weak from the start. If you want to study more about this strong German leader, it's imminent, as we say in our booklet. Go to that booklet, A Strong German Leader is Imminent. Or you can also listen to one of my programs from last week. I think the Friday program in particular. So it'd be right at the top of the Trumpet Daily Radio show box there at thetrumpet.com. You can look for that again at our website, thetrumpet.com. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
Herbert W. Armstrong long forecast the arrival of a military superpower in Europe. In a world where European nations can't rely on the United States, one in which they fear Russia and face the constant threat of radical terror, their only hope of survival is to band together. This is what we see happening. And what we see happening was prophesied in your Bible. Request Germany and the Holy Roman Empire to learn about the history of Germany and the Holy Roman Empire and to understand where the events in Europe today are leading. 3,000 years ago, the prophet Daniel explained that at the time of the end, radical Islam would push against Europe. That time is now. We are witnessing the first manifestations of this Islamist push against Europe, and it's leading to a spectacular clash between these two prophesied kings, the King of the North and the King of the South. What does the Bible say about the identity of these two kings? What about the end time? Will everyone be affected by these events? Request our two booklets, The King of the South and Germany and the Holy Roman Empire. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
Last time, I saw it all coming. And I cried aloud to my own fellow countrymen and to the world, but no one paid any attention. Up till the year 1933, or even 1935, Germany might have been saved from the awful fate which had overtaken her. And we might all have been spared the miseries Hitler let loose upon mankind. There never was a war in history easier to prevent by timely action than the one which had just desolated such great areas of the globe. It could have been prevented, in my belief, without the firing of a single shot. And Germany might be powerful, prosperous, and honored today. But no one would listen. And one by one, we were all sucked into the awful whirlpool. Miss Shirley, ladies and gentlemen, I put it to you, surely we must not let that happen again.
That's Winston Churchill, obviously, giving his speech following World War II. That was actually a speech in Missouri, the United States, that he gave on March 5th. 1946, talking about all of the warnings, the alarm that he was sounding during the 1930s, 1933, 1935, but no one paid attention. No one would listen. And so all of Britain, all of the Western world, I mean, they were, as he said there, sucked into this awful whirlpool. Just an awful, horrific World War II, with tens of millions of casualties, 60 million, some have said. And is it really true that it all could have been prevented without the firing of even a single shot? If someone, anyone, would have just stepped forward to take timely action, to take bold action? Churchill was a man of action. He certainly was. He was ready to act. He was crying out for others to act. And they wouldn't. Until they absolutely had to. Manchester, in his book, says, Churchill believed that if the Allies had taken a firm stand at Munich, that was 1938, it would have prevented the war. Just take a firm stand. Just give an ultimatum. Just draw a red line and stick to it. But no one else would act. One commentator wrote about Churchill, a man who knows that you must act to win. That's Winston Churchill. He knew that you had to act if you wanted to win. You couldn't just talk about it. It says here, you cannot remain supine and allow yourself to be hit indefinitely. Winston must be chafing at the inaction. It was as if Britain was just lying on the ground, being pummeled by Hitler. and not willing, not courageous enough to do anything, to even fight back. And of course, Churchill was there in the House of Commons saying that, look, we've got to project strength here. If we show the slightest sign of weakness, he said in one of his speeches, it's only going to aggravate the dangers which concern not only us, but the whole world. On another occasion, he said, halfway measures are more dangerous than none. I mean, we've got to go all the way. We've got to take some bold, decisive action, just like the way that he painted. And that tyrant in Germany would have submitted to that kind of courageous action, much like that canvas did to his paintbrush. Churchill, this is Manchester, Churchill loved risks and always sought ways to carry the war to the enemy. He always looked for ways to go on the offensive. My father in the War Against Sin book, he talked about how that the offensive is three or four times as hard as just passively enduring from day to day. He was quoting from Churchill, using Churchill again as an example. We've got to go on the offensive. Quoting Churchill, and my father says, it therefore requires all possible help in early stages, going on the offensive, that is. Nothing is easier to smother in the cradle. That's the key, though. You've got to be willing to act. You have to be prepared to act, and he did it. Even in all of the little ways, when he was first Lord of the Admiralty, Chamberlain finally made him that, in 1939, there, after Germany invaded Poland. I mean, all of Britain, they were calling upon Churchill to be put in government so that he could be used. But one of his assistants there, as First Lord of the Admiralty, he said every day, and I mean, he did have his afternoon nap, as I said at the start of the program, but he had also like 2 days of activity before and after the nap, all crammed into one. But he used to carry around these little red labels that he'd put upon action sheets or file folders, whatever it would be, the daily to-do list. And those red labels said, action this day. This is action that we've got to take today. And then when he finally did become the prime minister, well, Hitler had met his match, because Hitler was certainly a man of action. He was carrying out all this evil as fast as he could. With Hitler, there was a real sense of urgency. You didn't find that, though, in Britain. You didn't find it in London except with Winston Churchill. And then when he got in office, things began to change for the better. But before that happened, I mean, you read some of that history and think, how could it have been that bad? How could they get all the way to that point and still think that appeasement can work? I mean, even after Hitler's forces marched into Poland, Chamberlain and all of the men of Munich, as Manchester calls them, they still were looking for ways to talk their way out of that world war. He only finally took a firm stance on September 3rd, 1939. And the war started in the early hours of September 1st, Friday morning. And it took until Sunday for Chamberlain to say, all right, this means war. And this is after tens of thousands of Poles had been slaughtered. Even then, Chamberlain could not make a quick decision that this means action. And before Hitler's troops marched into Poland, Chamberlain, he was convinced that it was Polish obstinacy that was the obstacle to peace. He was convinced that the Poles were being obstinate, not Germany. Even the UK or the American ambassador to the UK, Joseph Kennedy, of the famous or infamous, I guess, depending on how you look at it, the the Kennedy clan, the patriarch of the Kennedy clan, and a lover of Hitler. But even he told the State Department in August of 1939 that Chamberlain is more worried about getting the Poles to be reasonable than the Germans. Poland, you've got to be reasonable. Look, Germany's doing everything that they can to try to keep the peace. That's really the message that was coming from London. Shockingly. Manchester, he says on page 515 of his book, this is the second volume, forcing the weak to submit is clearly easier than confronting the strong. Particularly if you have persuaded yourself that the weak deserve what is coming to them. At Berchtesgaden, Gottesberg, and Munich, these are all the places where they met for the appeasement sessions, Chamberlain had discovered flaws in the checks, which had previously escaped his attention. So it was now with the Poles. Neville Henderson, he was the UK ambassador to Germany, he was worried that the Poles might provoke the Führer's wrath and force, quote-unquote, force the Nazis to move against Poland. That was the other Neville, the other appeaser, the ambassador in Germany. He was basically saying, look, if Poland doesn't behave here, they're going to force the Nazis to act. As I say, you read back on this, and it's just, your head is constantly shaking. What in the world were they thinking? Hitler, a lot came out in the Nuremberg trials right after the war. Hitler had admitted to I think his translator, that he offered to negotiate in 1939 because he needed an alibi. He needed to be able to tell the German people, look, I've done everything I can to maintain peace. It's not my fault that I'm invading these weak countries. It's Britain's fault. It's Poland's fault. It's Czechoslovakia's fault. I'm just acting because I have to act. And isn't, just to draw some spiritual lessons from this, isn't this the way Satan wants for us to think? Satan's convinced that he's right. Satan is convinced that he has been wronged. And so he invents all kinds of grievances. He sees himself as a victim. And that's the way, in many ways, that's the way Hitler thought in 1939. And he had all of these alibis. He would lie and lie and lie again. And then he had the German press, the propaganda. They're covering for him as well. They would report on all of these ominous scenes of Polish troops mobilizing for war when it was actually the German troops that were pushing up against the Polish frontier. And yet in this environment, at that time, the British Prime Minister would march into negotiations and discover flaws, not in Germany, but he would discover flaws in Poland, in Czechoslovakia, in Austria. Well, if only they would behave, the Nazis would back away. As I say, Satan loves for us to think that he's been mistreated, or that he's been wronged unfairly. If you think about what the Bible says about our adversary, the devil, he comes as an angel of light, but what are his actions conveying? What do you see him doing if you're looking at the fruits? Well, far from being an angel of light, he's a roaring lion going about seeking whom he can devour. That's what 1 Peter 5 says. It says in verse 6, humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you in due time. Come under the authority of God. Humble yourselves before the mighty hand of God. Verse 7 continues, casting all your care upon him, for he cares for you. Be sober, verse 8 says. Be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, as a roaring lion, walks about seeking whom he may devour. See, we're all targets. And the ones that Satan really devours are the weak ones, the weaker nations. And as he goes on his rampage, while he's out there all simultaneously saying, look, I have no choice. I have no choice. Look, I've been provoked. And he just keeps picking off one after another, which is why we've got to remain steadfast, as Peter says here. We've got to be vigilant. We've got to be empowered by the Holy Spirit. We've got to stay on guard. We have to be prepared for battle. That takes constant, continual, vigilant effort. We can't ever, ever, ever let down. We've got to go on the offensive. We've got to be willing to take action. Are you a man or a woman of action? Think about that history once again. There never was a war in history easier to prevent by timely action than the one which has just desolated such great areas of the globe. It all could have been prevented or stopped in the early stages if someone, anyone, would have been willing to act, even at the point of Poland, as Manchester brings out in his book. When you look at all of the French divisions up against Germany's western border, and then, of course, Germany's preoccupied with Poland, sending most of its forces into Poland. They didn't have the strength at that point to fight a war on two fronts. If Poland would have decided the moment German troops go into Poland, or rather if France would have decided this together with Britain, but even if France was alone. But France was just playing defense. France was just securing its borders in case Germany ever came into France. No one would take the offensive. No one would take timely action. And Hitler knew that they wouldn't. He knew that the democracies would not mobilize to act. And so he marched right into Poland. He slaughters tens of thousands of people, and he gets away with it. Timely action. Could that whole war have been prevented by just a bit of action at the start? It sure could have. In 1935, 1937, 1938, 1939, Churchill was sounding the alarm, but no one was listening. Action this day, when you draw lessons from this history, like my father's booklet brings out, I mean, we've got to have a battle plan. We've got to be offensive-minded, and we've got to be willing, as Churchill was. We've got to be determined to take action this day. That was what was inspiring about seeing Chartwell, in particular, Churchill's office, his antique desk, the chair in which his secretary sat while she took dictation, the standing table where he reviewed the proofs, what she had typed the night before. And then he'd go through it and edit it. He'd edit a draft, whether it was for a speech or a chapter in a book or whatever. You see, this, it was like a factory. This was where the message was being generated. This was where the warning was being written and recorded. It was inspiring to see. And at the same time, you look at how much it took for the people of Britain to finally listen. No one would listen early on. And so the whole world was sucked into that awful whirlpool. Could history repeat itself? Churchill said, look, let me put it to you this way. Surely we must not let it happen again. Can it happen again? Will it happen again? Well, I mentioned Daniel 8 at the end of the last segment. Let me read it to you. Daniel 8 and verse 24, it says, "And his power shall be mighty." His power shall be mighty. That's the prophesied strong man. The Daniel 8 man. He is going to be backed by mighty power. And what I just read over in 1 Peter 5, it says, "Humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God." I mean, we have to have the mighty hand of God, the power of God, to face, to confront this power that shall be mighty. It says, but not by his own power. I mean, this is not some human being. Neither was it just a human being in Hitler's day. That man was possessed. That man was motivated by the devil. And the devil was inspiring him. The devil was moving him. And that's why you just had a nonstop flood of lies and propaganda and deceit. I just want to make peace. I mean, look at the poor Germans in Danzig. Look at the poor Germans in the Sudetenland. Look at how they're being mistreated. Look at how the Polish authorities or the Czech authorities are mistreating German people. Look at how they're threatening our borders. Look at how we've been mistreated. Look at how we were treated at Versailles. He's been wronged. Germany was wronged. That's what he was saying, and too many people during that time, they were ambivalent to this roaring lion. They did not recognize evil when it was right there in front of their faces. You know, when Churchill was appealing to Britain there in the late 1930s, he was talking about the need for a recovery of moral health. And how that, I don't remember, it's from my notes. I don't remember if it was Churchill who said this or Manchester, but they made the point, one of them made the point that the English needed to relearn how to recognize evil. The people of Britain, they didn't know what was evil at that time. And too many of them were cozying up to Hitler. I mean, it was worse than ambivalence. They rather admired it. They thought that, well, you know, maybe he has a point. Maybe he has a point. Maybe we should try to accommodate Adolf Hitler. Maybe we should try to understand what he's saying. And so they would. They sat down and they negotiated with the devil. And the devil was telling them, "Look, I've been wronged. I just want peace. If you just give me this, I'll be fine. I'll be satisfied." And the men of Munich kept doing that. They'd just give him more and more and more. And Churchill was there saying, look, people think that if they, or nations rather, are thinking that if we just give them this, then he won't come after us. He is coming after us. He's relentless. There's not going to be any let up. We've got to submit to the mighty hand of God. And then we can confront this other mighty power. He shall destroy wonderfully, it says in Daniel 8, 24, and shall prosper and practice and shall destroy the mighty and holy people. This is what we're facing off against. This is not just some physical being. Satan is behind this man. Daniel 8, 24 brings that out. Satan is behind this movement. Satan will be behind this final leader, strong man, to come in the spirit of Adolf Hitler. Verse 25, I again paraphrase this in the first segment, it says, "And through his policy also he shall cause craft to prosper in his hand, and he shall magnify himself in his heart, and by peace shall destroy many." By peace. You see, he comes in and says, well, all I've ever wanted is peace. Look, I'm a peacemaker. What was it? I gave it in a program recently. I think it was in the days before Hitler marched on Czechoslovakia. Chamberlain and his men were talking about the period of tranquility that Europe had entered into. Well, there's just peace. Look, he's right. He wants peace. We can talk sense with this man. The Bible says, and by peace he shall destroy many. My father wrote in Daniel Unsealed at Last, this man will destroy many people by preaching peace, peace, or love, love, but he practices the opposite. His is a policy of craft, of deceit, as it reads in the RSV. Satan is to blame above all. He is the father of lies. He never comes with warlike rhetoric. It's always with words of love and peace. You see, he's an angel of light. That's what 2 Corinthians 11 says. That's how Satan sees himself. I'm an angel. I'm not evil. I'm not wrong. I've been wronged. I've been mistreated. Which is why we've got to judge by the fruits. He comes in the name of peace and wreaks havoc on this earth. Everywhere that he goes, there's just a wide path of destruction. In this clip from 1939, Churchill, he's talking about General Goring of the Nazi machine and what Germany and these leaders underneath Hitler, what they said about their empire, about Nazi Germany. Here's clip two.
General Goring said that we have been spared so far because Nazi Germany is so humane. They cannot bear to do anything to hurt anybody. All they ask for is the right to live and to be let alone to conquer and kill the weak. Their humanity forbids them to apply severities to the strong.
This is why Hitler hated Churchill with a passion, because Churchill saw through the lies. He exposed the lies. He said, look, Goring can talk all that he wants about how humane the Nazi empire is, Nazi Germany is, how that they're not hurting anybody, how that they're trying to maintain the peace. But look, they're killing off one nation after another. Look at the fruits. Going back to some of these lessons again that we can take away from this, and a lot of this is brought out in our powerful booklet, The War Against Sin. It says here, in the last hour, my father says, false ministers also have power behind them, the power of Satan. See, it's just like you compare these two verses, 1 Peter 5 and verse 6, and then Daniel 8 and verse 24. I mean, there's power in both cases. The power of Satan and the power of God. Now, Satan and his power, they're no match. It's no match for God. But without God and his power, we are no match for the devil. Speaking of the power of the devil and these false ministers that he uses, it says, my father does, they are subtle in their deceit, but they can't deceive Christ, who is living in us, knowing the Spirit. He's commenting on a passage of Scripture in 1 John 4. You can study that later. Knowing the Spirit goes beyond hearing the words of a man. Get to know the Spirit of God as deeply as you can. Look at the fruits. The Spirit is coming in the flesh of God's leader, his ministry, and his people. You've got to know. I mean, you've got to be able to know not just the words of these two leaders, whether it's a true minister or a false minister. I mean, you've got to be discerning of the Spirit behind it. And for, just to go back to the historical example here, for Chamberlain to go into those meetings looking for flaws in Czechoslovakia or in Poland, I mean, it shows that he wasn't discerning the Spirit. He wasn't judging by fruits. He wouldn't confront evil. He wanted to appease. He deceived himself He wanted to believe it so badly. The fact that Hitler was a peacemaker, that even when all of these facts were just being hurled in his face, he still would look at Poland as being the problem. Not Germany, Poland. Well, it makes you appreciate this history and then what we know, what we've witnessed in the spiritual abomination of desolation. All of the destruction since the death of Herbert Armstrong. It makes you appreciative of God's truth. John 17, his word is truth. Satan, however, is the father of lies. And he's out there telling lies nonstop. Well, to discern the truth, to know the truth, we've got to not only receive it, to accept it, we've got to act on it. And timely action means act right away. Confront it at the earliest possible moment. Even before you have to fire a single shot. That's the offensive-minded approach that we want to take when it comes to confronting and battling against and overcoming sin. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to submit a request, feedback, whatever it is, you can email us at td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.